Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Gee, it's great to have him back and great to have you listening in. If you have a question about wildlife, things that are going on in your backyard maybe or around the state, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back.
Hello, Larry, and happy April Fool's Day.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, it's a great
spring. How appropriate that I'd be here on April Fool's Day.
Spring. Well, spring is almost spring. You know, it doesn't seem very spring-like out there on April. Mother Nature's doing a little April Fool on us here. It's cold out there.
It is cold. It's making me a little nervous. I have my class field trip for reptiles and amphibians coming up in a few weeks, and things need to turn around a bit. It was so nice back on St. Patty's Day. It was 70 degrees, and everything was happening, and now walking over here seeing the students dressed the way they were, it doesn't look much like spring.
No, it sure doesn't. But there's still things we can do in the outdoors.
Many things. Many things. In fact, spring really has sprung. A lot of the birds are back. Salamanders have been migrating. There are lots of things that are showing up on our spring phenology list that we maintain kind of in the hallway there at the office, and everybody mm-hmm. just makes an entry when they see one. But there are a lot of spring basics we could discuss today that people need to be thinking about as they're headed back out into their yards and they see damage that occurred over winter, or they're thinking about their gardening and spring planting and what should they do to protect against wildlife problems, and what are they seeing in terms of animal activity. So there are lots of things there, and there are, of course, lots of spring events between the turkey season and the Conservation Congress hearings and a whole variety of other things.
Frankie in Fort Atkinson, actually, he's already emailed us and wonders if we should stop feeding birds now because of the salmonella issues.
Well, there have been lots of calls. I've had, I think, an email a day for the last few days about people noticing dead birds around their feeder, and it seems to be primarily when the DNR came out with a press release on it a couple weeks ago, it was primarily kind of a central and a little further north issue, and it was affecting pine siskins and a variety of finches and most of the smaller feeder birds, which is typical. But in any event, it does appear to be salmonella. Salmonellosis is the issue that is at hand, and it's one of those things where, yes, you can stop feeding, but you need to bring the feeders in and clean them up to effectively stop feeding. And if you can, clean things up on the ground a little bit. But I think it's possible to continue your feeder operation if you do bring the feeders in, clean them in a weak disinfectant solution, weak bleach or Lysol solution, rinse them off, sure, air dry them, refill them, and get them back up. You should be okay. And as it does warm up, finally, when it does finally warm up, and some of these smaller, the siskins and redpolls and some of those things move north, then hopefully this will all come to an end. But it does seem to be a fairly widespread outbreak and more problems than we've seen in recent years.
Bonnie in Oconomowoc is up with a question for you. Let's go to Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I have a sighting that I would like more information on. We have a sugar maple tree outside of our dining room window, which we have feeders on. And we have many squirrels and birds, mostly gray squirrels. We have one red squirrel that comes around once in a while. But yesterday we had a squirrel that was smaller than a gray squirrel, looked like a gray squirrel, except it had a red stripe down its back. Is this a hybrid red-gray squirrel?
Probably not. Two completely different species, and they also don't get along all that well in the wild. So the only thing that troubles me a little bit in the observation is we say it's smaller than a gray squirrel. A lot smaller than a gray squirrel?
Oh, I would say about two-thirds the size of a gray squirrel.
Well, I mean, it's possible red squirrel, but you're sure it's not a red squirrel. Does it have the eye ring of a red squirrel?
No, it looks like a gray squirrel with a red stripe down its back and a red tail.
Then I think we should take things at face value, and it probably is a gray squirrel with a red stripe down its back and a rusty tail. For whatever reason, and we talked about this a bit last year, there were lots of accounts of people all across the state seeing all sorts of aberrant colors and color phases of gray squirrels. white ones, black ones, brown ones, all shades of brown, part brown, part black. I remember one that looked like it had been dipped in a paint can. The front end was dark, the back end was light. All sorts of weird color combinations. And at the time, we tried to do a little tracking through the Zoology Museum and some folks around the country who pay attention to all things squirrel. And we're not able to come up with a whole lot. I mean, you can blame it on the economy or global climate change or whatever you want. But for whatever reason, for the last year or two, there's just been a rash of oddly colored squirrels. And I just got my new copy of Wisconsin Outdoor News a couple days ago. And again, there was a picture well featured in there of a very light colored squirrel with flecking of a nice mahogany brown. Very pretty squirrel, but again, very strangely colored. So this has been happening a fair bit. Squirrel colors, of course, it's a genetic issue, and there are normal color phases of gray squirrels. There's a golden yellow one that's quite common, or relatively common, and then, of course, there are melanistic gray squirrels, which are black, and albinos are also possible. So in a normal sense, there could be gray, black, white, and then this golden yellow color. And what apparently has happened is there is a lot of variation in between those rather discrete color phases. And in terms of why it's happening or what's going on, I can't explain it. But I think what you're seeing is just an unusually colored gray squirrel.
And thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Carl in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I've got a question that's 21 years old. And something happened on Gene Farkas' program a couple of months ago that makes me want to ask this question. I was in St. John's, Newfoundland in 1988, September, middle to late September, going out to, I can't remember if it's called Cape Spear or Point Spear, and we went over like a culvert. The ocean was to the left, maybe 100 yards away, and there was a bog to the right, and there was this huge moose. I mean, he was maybe not much more than 25 yards away, and we pulled over to watch him. He was belly high, belly deep, maybe a little bit more in the water. Sometimes he was less than belly deep, and he was sometimes stripping of foliage off of plants, you know, sticking his head down and ripping. Other times he'd just bite off the bunch at the top, and he'd start shaking his head, and it was just great because his head would be way up in the air, but there were these tall trees with the sun filtering through and hitting the water that was, you know, coming off of it like little diamonds. And what I wonder about, Scott, is how much time do moose spend in water and eating swamp vegetation?
A lot of time in the water. I mean, when moose hunters tend to pursue them around bodies of water, along river systems and lake shores, bogs, and things like that. It's a key element in their habitat, and they spend a lot of time in the water foraging and feeding on aquatic plants exactly the way you saw them or saw that one. And they spend some time in the water avoiding insect problems and things like that. But what you saw was very typical moose behavior and a very common sight in Newfoundland since 1988 when you were there. Newfoundland is pretty much overrun with moose. There are a lot of moose, and it's known as quite the destination for people interested in seeing or hunting moose these days. So what you saw was very typical behavior.
And thank you for calling, Carl. Appreciate your call. And Kathy in Denmark. Well, on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We live in about a 15-acre hardwood forest south of Denmark, and now there are no leaves, and I see a pair of crows making a nest. And it's the first time I've ever seen one because they tend to hide. But do they have babies already?
No, it's a little early for most of the only things that nest very early are things like great horned owls and whatnot that are notorious for beginning nesting in February. Yeah. But most everything else, in fact, I alluded to our phenology list in the department, and one of the entries I just noted this morning was probably a week or 10 days ago that someone noted that they'd seen crows carrying nesting material. Mm-hmm. So it's that time of year to get things underway for a lot of birds, but it's too early for young.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Julie in Eau Claire, your turn now. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. Now, I'm not one of these anti-hunting radicals, but I heard that coyote hunting is allowed year-round. Now, they obviously have pups in the den, which obviously must starve to death, which certainly doesn't mix a lot of people against hunting. And I'm just wondering, why is there the year-round season? And then my second quick question, can a hawk get an adult duck? Because a year ago, I know it was a duck, but I don't know what was after. It was coming full speed after it, but it was no bigger than the adult duck. And I was wondering if hawks go after them. And thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Well, yes, they certainly – last question first. And, yes, there are certainly some hawks that will take a duck or try and take a duck. And even eagles will harass the ducks on occasion. So nothing too unusual there. As far as the coyote situation – I guess I'd have to look at my regulation. I thought we did have a closed
season. Well,
I know there's a closed season, and there's some debate about it. In fact, it may be coming up at the Conservation Congress hearings to try and actually reopen the season on coyotes during the deer season in northern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And the primary reason there, which I think is a closure north of Highway 10, has been to protect the wolf population against mistaken identity and have people shooting coyotes or shooting what they think is a coyote and actually killing a wolf. And that happened last winter down in Lafayette County, right almost on the Illinois line, when an individual thought he shot what he thought was a large coyote, and it turned out to be a wolf. So there are some season closures designed more to protect wolves than the coyotes, but I thought there was an overall season as well. I understand your concern for hunting anything during the breeding period when orphaned young might, of course, be compromised.
Sure.
But I guess someone can call in or we can look it up on the DNR website here when we have a down moment and we'll report back to you, Julie. But I thought there was a closure at some times of the year.
Somebody else emailed, by the way, speaking of coyotes, to ask, when is the coyote breeding season?
Well, that's also on now. Yeah. And they've probably been exhibiting breeding behavior and mating since well back into February and are now probably denned up, and we'd see pups being born before too much longer into April. The whole coyote situation is one of the things on our hit list here to cover because there's been lots of – one of the reasons for attempting to lift some of the protection on coyotes is that there's increasing concern about coyotes in urban suburban areas, not only just around Madison here where we've had several incidents in the last few weeks that are leading up to an actual forum on Madison's west side on April 22nd, where a number of us will be talking about coyote biology and management and how people could or should interact with them. But this is a problem in the greater Chicago area, virtually any metropolitan area. So there's growing concern that maybe we need to put a little more of a lid on the coyote population. That's easier said than done. Humans have tried to contain coyotes for many, many, many years, and it just hasn't worked out all that well. It's worked out okay for the coyotes, not so well for the folks interested in control. But that may be the genesis of some of these questions.
Yeah, it could be. My wife actually spotted a dead coyote on Madison's west side on Sunday. It had been hit by a car along the side of the road, so certainly out and around. Thanks, Julie. Appreciate the call. Norm in New Auburn. We'll get to you in just a second, but just to remind everyone that Scott Craven's our guest, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and as always, answering the phones, Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and just to go back to our earlier caller, there is a coyote season. There's a trapping season. Hunting season. It's open season except closed the Northern Wisconsin Wolf Management during the regular deer hunt. Trapping is from October 17th to February 15th in the north, October 31st to February 15th in the south. But it is only closed during the deer hunting season. Now, Norm in New Auburn, it's your turn. Hi, Norm.
Hello. I have a mountain ash tree. And I'd kind of like to get it to grow, but the deer keep eating it up.
Yeah.
And I put stuff on it, and they still do it.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do?
I don't think any amount of stuff, Norm, is actually going to help the problem. And by stuff, I'm referring to chemical repellents or hanging bars of soap or human hair, all that other stuff. Uh-huh. I think if you really – is it a single stem or is it kind of a bushy mountain
single
ash?
Single stem.
And how tall is it?
Oh, they ate it. down to half. It's about 3 feet high now.
Okay, then I think the only way you're going to get that up out of reach for them is the same thing I've had to do with a few mountain ash on my property, and that's build a welded wire cylinder that you can put around it, so essentially it's they're fenced away from it. So you can just get a 4 or 5 foot width of welded fencing wire and bend that around into a circle, or wrap it around the tree essentially, and then just hook the links together on the cut end, and you've effectively got a 5 foot protective barrier around it.
It's about the only thing you can do for sure.
That'll give it a chance to get up above what they can reach, and any low growth they may continue to prune off. But if you can get that growing tip up above what they can reach, above 6 feet, say, you're home free.
Will they eat the bark?
They won't eat the bark, but they'll eat any new growth in terms of twigs or shoots. And if a buck happens to be going by and it's a nice, clean, open stem, he may rub the bark off, which will result in the same problem. But that's why I say you need to get that growth, wire protective barrier on there. And in 2 or 3 years, it should have escaped their reach.
All right. Good luck. Thank you. Jane in New London, on to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In the middle of summer, we have a pond that's kind of in a woody, marshy area, and there's a bird down there. I hear the call. I haven't seen it. It's a series of about 4 or 5 descending trills, very haunting, very echoey, and as near as I can tell from, you know, just paging through my bird book, I think it might be a veery. And I wondered if you knew anything about those.
Not a lot. When does it call during the day?
It's in the evening.
Hmm.
Just at twilight.
Well, there are a couple of issues here, and one of them may surface in a few minutes when we play a few sounds. I guess I'm... Are you sure it's not a frog?
Oh, no, it's not a frog. No, I know all the frog sounds.
Okay.
And it reminds me, you know, we have sandhill cranes, too, and mm-hmm. it has that same kind of, you know, echoey quality when it's in the woods.
Well, it tends to get quiet in the evening, and I know we're preparing to head up to northern Wisconsin here in mid-May to teach our summer field camp with the students. And one of the things the students enjoy, and I enjoy, is just before dark, when particularly the wood thrushes, but all the members of that group, of which the veery belongs, tend to sing just as it's getting dusk, and it's usually quiet, and the song is very musical, very beautiful, and it carries very well through the woods. So I don't doubt that that's what you're hearing. You seem to know, you dismiss the frog situation. My suggestion is that you just go online if you've not heard the calls or don't have a bird call tape or CD. Go online to any of the birding websites like ebird.org, and you can easily call up a veery and listen to the call, or listen to some of the other thrushes and verify for yourself what you're hearing.
Sure.
Oh, okay. I did look, but I just have a dial-up connection, and it takes forever.
I understand, but there are other ways to do it. You can find a friend who can play it for you over the phone, or stop at the public library, or there are a variety of ways to check. But if you've got a pretty good mental image or auditory image of what you're hearing, just verify it against the recorded calls, and that'll clear it up for you.
Clear it up. All right. Good luck, Jane. Thank you very much for calling. Brent in La Crosse County, on to you. Hi, Brent.
Hi, Scott and Larry.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about your phenology list in your department,
mm-hmm.
how your students would write it, their observations down
mm-hmm.
on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that idea. I have a real informal one where I just write, first red wing
That's
on the calendar and stuff like that. But does your list have sort of categories where, you mentioned crows gathering nesting material, or is it just up to the students to write down what they see, or do you
it's, have certain... it's entirely up to the students and anybody else that's going by, and I keep these from year to year, and we see all sorts of things on the list, like, first softball game across the street, or first sunbathers out by the dormitories, or all sorts of things that aren't really part of the natural world, but they tend to be first arrival dates, first bloom dates, First lilacs out, first tulips in bloom, the crocuses are out, that kind of thing. So it's kind of catch-as-catch-can, but there are a few things that are so common from year to year, like the first robins or redwings showing up, that always turns up. And as a result, phenology lists are a pretty good index toward what's going on in any given season. And certainly there's some year-to-year variation, early spring, late spring, and so forth. But what phenology observers are, I think they're really going to come into their own over the next few years, in that there's a tremendous and building interest in monitoring the impacts of global climate change as it occurs. And these phenology lists are some of the things that have pointed to the changes, leading people to conclude climate change is a real issue. And there is a national phenology clearinghouse now, and I know there are a couple of groups of professionals working in the state who are talking about invoking or involving more people in citizen science projects that involve phenology. So, Brent, you've got a chance to just kind of keep track on your own calendar, but I think there are going to be more formal records that you can contribute to data collection on a statewide basis. You can also report your phenological events at websites like Wisconsin Nature Mapper, which a lot of people have gotten involved with. And if you're interested in sort of checking what you're seeing against a standard, NRCS offices, the Federal Natural Resources Conservation Service, in conjunction with the Fish and Wildlife Service and University Extension and some other folks, put out an annual calendar which has phenological events actually printed on the calendar. Kind of average date for this happens now, this happens then, and you could probably get that from your local NRCS office and then put your observations right on there.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I was looking for, NRCS.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, thanks a lot for calling. We have a question, an email from Chris in Green Bay. He writes, my father was a big duck hunter, and I hunted with him as a kid. He used to take me out driving to the Black Creek and Shiocton rural areas in the spring to watch the migration and see how many different types of ducks and geese we could identify. He's now suffering from early stages of Alzheimer's, and I was thinking of taking him on this drive. I was wondering if the prime migration is already passed or if it would still be worth taking this drive. Is there anywhere else we could visit on a short day trip from Green Bay?
Wow, that's a neat question. I can think of a lot of things, Chris. For one thing, you're not too late at all. We've got, at least here in southern Wisconsin, we've got lots of flooded fields, and the waterfowl are just packing in. I saw my first flock of shovelers driving home last night on the side of the road, and there are a lot of things back. There are a lot of things yet to come. So I think that as progression moves north, and I was just talking to my buddy up at Kemp Station in Minocqua before I came over to the station. He said it's snowing like crazy, and the ground's still frozen like a rock, and there's 30 inches of ice on Lake Tomahawk. So if the ducks have piled into southern and central Wisconsin, they're going to be stuck here for a little while. So I think actually your timing is great, and you've probably got at least a several-week window into the future to wait for a nice, warm, sunny day and get out and look around. There are a couple of approaches you might consider. One is to just drive around, look for flooded fields and wetlands. You should see waterfowl everywhere. The other one is, we were just talking on the last program, Larry, about these great birding and nature trail guides, the set of which was just completed. So I would urge Chris or anybody else to head to a DNR office or a nature center or a tourism division office and get a copy of those great birding trail, or at least the one for your area, and this will direct you to the prime viewing sites in your area. And then, of course, the other possibility is to head out to a well-known place like Horican Marsh or whatnot, just an hour southwest of Green Bay, and there'll be all kinds of stuff along Highway 49. So lots of possibilities.
Lots of possibilities. We were looking out my back lawn onto Lake Monona the other morning, and I had within sight and about 20 yards from the shore, we had loons, goldeneye, mergansers, and buffaloheads all right there. It was really fun.
Yep. So they're certainly back. So by no means, Chris, have you missed it. I urge you to get your dad out there and see some of these things.
Barbara in Madison, it's on to you now. Hi, Barb.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Larry and Scott. I'm just kind of excited to report this. And, Scott, I want you to know where I am. And you'll know because I was a neighbor of yours three houses south when you lived in Fitchburg.
Okay.
And we have a big bird feeder outside of our kitchen window. It's very tall. It's got a dome on it. And attached to that, we have a suet cake. Last year, we had a pair of ravens for about 2 weeks, which was really, really rare. It took us a long time to figure out they really weren't huge crows. But when we really looked it up, we could tell by the beak and the way the wings lay on the body,
mm-hmm.
and also the legs, that they actually were ravens. This year, we've seen them twice so far since Sunday. I just want to know, how rare is that? Or are they migrating, or do we have ravens in the area?
It's rare, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah, it's quite unusual. I can't say that I've ever. I really like ravens.
Oh,
first
yeah,
of
I do
all,
too.
We've talked about this in the program before. Not only are they big and so forth,
mm-hmm.
but there's nothing that I enjoy hearing in the North Woods where you would normally expect ravens.
Yeah.
Nothing I enjoy hearing other than maybe loons, other than the kind of gurgling, weird
yeah.
cry of a raven. It sounds
it's
like
wonderful.
You're back in a prehistoric bog somewhere. So they are really neat. I can't say as I've ever seen one this far south that I identified as such.
That's what the book but said, too, so I was curious.
It is pretty unusual, and it's especially strange you've seen them, you know, twice in your own yard. Typically, they don't migrate. I mean, they hang out where they are. I would, if I were you, I would call the Madison Audubon Society office, and that's in the phone book. I think it's 255-BIRD. But in any event, call Madison Audubon and report that. They're always interested in unusual bird observations in the area, and I wouldn't be terribly surprised if somebody's interested in coming out if there's any predictability to when or how you see them.
It's morning, and sometimes last year they came so frequently that I could actually tell there was a pair, a
mm-hmm.
little bit of difference, you know, between the two different birds anyway.
Yeah.
And they tend to feed in the morning. Sometime between 7:15 and 8 o'clock.
Well,
they just hacked that suet cake to pieces.
That is a pretty neat observation. And as I say, call it into Madison Audubon and see what they have to say.
Yeah,
thank you. I just wanted to share it and to actually find out how rare it was.
Yeah,
it's very rare.
Very rare. You should take some pictures. My goodness, Barb, you got to get some pictures of that because it is a rare event. Although, your home over there in Fitchburg, it was a nice wooded area there, if I'm not mistaken, in your old homestead back in Fitchburg.
In my failing memory, I can just barely remember.
I remember
Larry,
your backyard.
No, it was a nice area, but we're pretty happy with the current backyard and so forth. But I have no ravens, so that I'm envious.
Let's take Peg in Rice Lake next. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. Well, I have a bone to pick about coyotes.
All right.
I love coyotes to begin with. Got along fine with them out here. I wonder why we keep wanting to kill a moth. I know they've been pests, and I know that the more that we've tried to poison and shoot and every other manner of disposing of them, the more unsuccessful it was. Well, I think I can tell you why, and why doesn't anyone else know this? I have a little book here called The Track of the Coyote.
Mm-hmm.
It's put together by the Park Service out at Yellowstone, and they did a study on coyotes because they had moved the wolves out and now the coyotes predominated. They found that they pack up into family packs like wolves, and when they do this, only the alpha pair breed. The others help babysit. They help take care of the young ones. That's very fine. It's a pretty stable group. But you move in and you start breaking up that family pack, everybody breeds. You get more coyotes. Doesn't anyone know this?
Well, yes, it's pretty well. I think coyotes have been well studied, and their breeding and other behavior in response to persecution is pretty well understood. The recent change you might be interested in following in Yellowstone, of course, is that now the coyotes are on the run because the wolves are back, and coyotes and wolves don't get along so well. So there's been some changes out there, too. But you're correct in the first regard that coyotes have been persecuted since European settlers first hit the American plains when they were restricted to the American plains in the West. And you're right, they've been poisoned, bombed, trapped, dug out of their dens, shot at, everything else humans can think of. And yet, not only do they continue to exist and flourish, but they've also extended their range over most of the continent. So in the face of persecution, they've done very well. But the other side of the issue, in terms of, you know, not perhaps being able to understand why people would be doing this, there are some very legitimate problems. First of all, in the West, it's more of an issue than it is here, but livestock predation is a huge issue, particularly on sheep in some of the Western states. Of course, deer hunters are concerned when they hear that coyotes take fawns. But what's gotten people most excited recently, and this is what we were talking about earlier on the edges of our communities like Madison or Milwaukee or Chicago, is a coyote's propensity to take pets, smaller pets, cats, mm-hmm. small dogs. And there's been plenty of documentation of this recently, and there's also been some documentation lately around the country of particularly bold coyotes acting aggressively toward people with some attacks. And this has got people in residential neighborhoods pretty excited, and there's lots of call for some action. Whether the action will meet the same fate that the longstanding persecution of coyotes has met, it remains to be seen. But there are lots of people clamoring for some action and attention on this matter. So stand by. It's a work in progress. But you're absolutely right there. Very adaptable, very capable, very interesting animal. And I'm relatively confident that no matter what we do, they're not going anywhere.
All right. Thanks, Peg. Susan and Summit, to you.
A question about coyotes too. We've got 25 acres between Madison and Milwaukee, and we've got a lot of coyotes, and I love them, and we love to hear them call and everything, but we've also got two Welsh Corgi dogs, and the dogs seem to like them too, and twice now we've had the dogs outside and the coyotes have come up in the yard and seem to be playing with our dogs. And what I was curious, I saw a wolf movie once where they'd send out a female wolf to try and bring a dog back to the pack. And I'm like, okay, do coyotes do that same thing? Or are they really playing?
Well, the intentions of the coyotes are known only to the coyotes, but the behavior that you describe has been reported to me several times. In fact, I got several weeks ago, I got a really nice YouTube video from a gentleman over your way, actually, with a large dog, and he had a terrific video of a coyote coming into the yard and what appeared to be frolicking with the dog. Now, the coyote's intentions tend to vary a bit depending on the season, the status and interests of the coyote in question. With smaller pets, they certainly will kill them on occasion. With larger dogs, there are sometimes attacks, and the dog ends up injured. The coyote might be injured too, for that matter. Mm-hmm. But there are also cases during the breeding season when the result of a coyote-dog interaction is a hybrid called a coy dog. So that happens too. The notion of play is a bit out. It's kind of anthropomorphic and a bit out of play, out of place rather, in dealing with coyotes and dogs. But I think that the notion of luring the dog out of the yard and that there are a ring of coyotes waiting just in the brush where you can't see them, ready to pounce, is a bit overplayed and also a bit of a myth and anthropomorphic. But what those individual coyotes' intentions are, I can't tell you. But the advice going out now, if you've got small dogs or cats, house cats you're concerned about, and there are coyotes around, you need to keep a much closer eye on your pets and a better pet management in terms of keeping them inside to the extent that you can than maybe you've done in the past.
And there you have it. Thank you very much, Susan, for calling. Appreciate your call. Larry from Wazika, who's a block from the Kickapoo River, emailed us, said, last winter, my mother had a red-headed woodpecker at her bird feeders. He was king of the hill this winter. But this winter he wasn't around and just started showing up at the feeders, assuming the same bird, just recently. We have been using a fantastic woodpecker blend like granola. I've been thinking of eating some of it for breakfast, he says. How come we didn't see a red-headed woodpecker all winter and now he shows up? We've had a lot of downy and red bellies over the winter, but not the red-headed.
Well, having a red-headed at a feeder is a bit unusual anyway.
Yeah.
They're not a major feeder bird. Insect feeders and their behavior is a bit different than some of the other woodpeckers. So if you've got one at all, even if it's intermittent, you're doing pretty well and you should enjoy it. They're a beautiful bird. Their populations are in fairly steep decline, not nearly as common as they used to be in rural Wisconsin. So my advice to Larry would be enjoy it when you have it.
Yeah.
And keep up whatever woodpecker blend you're using if it seems to like it. But typically they're not a big feeder visitor at all.
Dion in Neillsville, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. For the last year, we have had a male cardinal that tries to get in, basically, every window in our home. It wakes us up in the morning and it'll sit on the edge of the window ledge looking in at us. It'll come around to the south side of our house. We have windows, big floor-to-ceiling windows. It'll sometimes sit on the ledge and look in, or it'll fly up to the top of the window and kind of slide down. It has done it for 1 year. It did not stop after the nesting season. What is going on?
Well, I expected that a call like this, Dion, to come up today because they've started to come into the office in terms of cardinals and occasionally some other species, particularly robins.
Yeah.
Attacking windows, and the party line here, and you obviously realize you've got something of an unusual situation, but the party line is that behavior now starts about this time of year and will run through the nesting season, you know, maybe sometime in May before the birds kind of give up and move off. And it in 99% of the cases, it's a territorial behavior. Where the male has kind of set up shop in the yard or in a bush or shrub or tree nearby, and presumably there's a nest or eventually will be a nest nearby too. And these birds are highly territorial, so the bird's sitting there in the bush and looks over at the window, and what appears in the window from the bird's perspective but another cardinal or another robin. They see their reflection, and then they vigorously attack it, thinking they're driving a competing male out of their territory. And, of course, the reflection never goes away. So they attack and they fall back and they see it again and attack and they fall back and they attack and it goes on and on and on and on. And it can be extremely annoying and tedious and sometimes even harmful for the bird and get dirt all over the windows and it's a mess.
Yeah.
But it does go away with time. And there are ways the windows can be protected or covered or the reflection muted so that the problem is minimized. The only surefire way, much as when we were talking to the gentleman about protecting his mountain ash from deer, the only sure way is to prevent access to the window, and that's by draping a sheet of black plastic bird mesh, the same stuff you would use to cover fruit trees or berry bushes or whatever from bird depredations. It's any garden center carries it in big sheets. It's inexpensive. It's almost invisible from 10 feet away. And if you can space it out away from the window 4 or 5 inches and drape it down, the bird can't get at its reflection. And that will stop the problem.
But
now, that's the issue. What's going on in your case where the bird is attacking year-round? Or at least show some curiosity.
Sitting there year round.
Sitting there. And I've got to think that since this it's so unusual that it goes year round, that you've either got a bird that's got something of a hormonal imbalance and it's displaying its territoriality longer than would be normally displayed, or there's some other attraction. The bird would have no interest in getting in. And while there are other birds that will routinely sit on the edge of a window or go to the top, as you described, and flutter down, those are usually birds that are interested in insects or spiders or whatnot that are attracted to the corners of the window, and they're actually catching bugs or feeding off the window. And in the case of woodpeckers, they're attacking the wood molding of the window. So the cardinal's behavior, I cannot explain. It's gone well beyond what the normal window attacking or reflection attacking behavior should be. And your options are fairly limited since it moves from window to window. I don't think you want to drape the whole house in netting. There may be a couple windows that it's particularly fond of that you could protect that way and see what happens. But you may have to outlast, in this case, not the territorial behavior, but the longevity of the bird. And if it's especially annoying to you and really problematic, the only other outlet I can suggest, it would be unusual, but I would contact the USDA Wildlife Services office. The state office is in Sun Prairie, and indicate that you have a bird problem. And in they do have the authority. For example, they would be the people you would go to with a woodpecker problem on siding, where a permit would be issued to remove the offending woodpecker. It would be very unusual and perhaps impossible to obtain a permit for this kind of a problem. But because it seems to have gone well beyond the normal territorial issue, for which no permit would be issued, fairly certain. Since it's gone well beyond that, it's possible that you might be able to obtain a permit to trap and remove the bird or capture and remove the bird. Mm-hmm. But you'd have to check up on that.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, the only options you have are to pursue that route or to attempt to start covering some windows to move it away.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Pleased to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Scott's examining an email we just received. Scott, what you got a picture there, a photo there.
Yes, it's a very nice photo, considering it's black and white and it's been transmitted through cyberspace. But it clearly is what the writer here suggests it was, and that's a white-winged crossbill. Second such picture I've received in the last week or so, and the other person who contacted me at the office had the same question. Anyway, it's a crossbill. They're rather unusual. It's a northern bird. They do coniferous forests. They use that weird crossed-over upper and lower bill to open cones and extract seeds. And so it tends to be a bird of northern coniferous forests. But this one, I think, is in the Wausau area, so that's within range. Not usually, sometimes seen during the winter, occasionally at feeders. The other one was at a feeder. This one apparently was captured on the ground feeding on spruce cones, which is what they do. There you have it.
And let's see, we had Steve also with an email asking you to please comment on the cougars sighted at Trigo. How do cougars establish a territory or find a mate, and how much room do they need?
Well, there was a couple weeks ago, there was quite a bit of email traffic regarding a cougar that was treed by some houndsmen in northwestern Wisconsin, in Burnett County. It was clearly a cougar. I mean, there were fabulous pictures of it. And a crew came in and attempted to tranquilize the animal. And the intent was to try and get a radio transmitter on it and collect some biological information, much the same as they were interested in doing for the cougar that was down in Milton last winter.
Yeah.
So there was no question that it was a cougar. Its origin remained unclear, so they were hoping to get some genetic samples to do the same kind of analysis they did on the Milton cougar. It was my understanding they did manage to get some samples, but they did not manage to get the cougar. It shook off the first bit of tranquilization and left the area, and it was picked up again the next day, treed again, tranquilized again, but once again got out of the tree and kind of wandered off into a large marsh area, and that's the last I've heard of it. So I think the decision was, since they had the biological samples, rather than put the animal at great risk, and there were a lot of local folks who were out looking around for it and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think they just decided to take the pressure off the animal. Whether it's been found again or whether now that there's some fresh snow up there it's still being tracked, I don't know. But it was clearly a cougar. My guess up there was that it was yet another animal moving across Minnesota from the source population in the Dakotas. Where it is now, some people may know, but I don't.
Okay. Gene and Big Bend, we're on to you now. Hi, Gene.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. We've been feeding birds here in Big Bend at the same location for 46 years, yet this winter, the first time we've had the small red squirrels. Are they ordinarily living in this part of the state?
What county are you in, Jim?
Waukesha.
Yeah, the, you know, as far as Wisconsin's concerned, if you think back to a basic botany class at the university, all the students are exposed to a notion kind of formulated, I guess, by a famous botanist here on campus who wrote The Vegetation of Wisconsin. His name was John Curtis, and he coined a phrase called the tension zone. And it's kind of a band of transitional vegetation that starts up in the northwest and kind of snakes through central Wisconsin in an S and then makes a real dogleg and moves down along the shoreline of Lake Michigan. And this is kind of it. It's not a straight east-west line that separates north and south, but what it does do is separate the southern range boundaries of a lot of northern species and the northern range boundaries of a lot of southern species. I think I said that correctly.
You did.
So anyway, it's kind of a band through Wisconsin. If you drive north on 51 or 39, you're headed up to Eagle River to go fishing, you can tell when you're driving through this area and you make the transition from the central sands, the southern Wisconsin farm country, into the north woods, so to speak. For me, it's going up the big hill on the north side of Wausau and all of a sudden, okay,
yeah.
I'm in the north woods again. And this band of vegetation, including a number of tree species, does bend down along the Lake Michigan shoreline because of the climatic influence of Lake Michigan. And there are some animal species follow the same kind of distributional patterns, red squirrels being one thing. So red squirrels have been known, and there are many records of squirrels extending much further south along the Lake Michigan shoreline than they do if you're in interior Wisconsin. So it's not that unusual, but obviously it's unusual in your particular setting, but they are found further south there than anywhere else.
Someone emailed about flying squirrels. And wondered if they are distributed throughout Wisconsin. And I think
there are two flying squirrels in the state, the southern and the northern. You'd expect the southern to be in the south and the northern in the north, but that's not the way it works. The southern, which is the smaller one, is actually found now statewide.
Yeah.
If you look in a mammals book like Jackson's Mammals of Wisconsin, it would show the southern flying squirrel in the southern two-thirds of the state. But over the last 10 or 20 years, they've extended all the way to Lake Superior. And when we're capturing squirrels as part of our field exercises for that summer camp I mentioned, we catch lots of southern flying squirrels just outside Minocqua. So we're well into the north woods. The northern flying squirrel is a little bit bigger, was truly northern, and seems to be less common than it once was. Maybe it's being displaced by the little more aggressive southern one. Maybe not. But we've not captured, and I have no previous experience with the northern flying squirrels. We have a grad student up there working on flying squirrels, and I think she has seen or caught a couple of northerns, but again, the bulk are southern flying squirrels. What's that mean? Well, for the general public, yes, there are flying squirrels everywhere in Wisconsin. They're strictly nocturnal, so they're not commonly seen unless they're visiting a feeder or you happen to knock down a hollow tree cutting firewood or they're in your cabin attic, but they're out there.
Margaret in Reedstown has a question for you. Margaret, hello.
Hi. Actually, when I was listening to you talk about cougars, I didn't hear your answer to the question about the territory of cougars.
Oh.
Because I did see a cougar. I'm sure it was. It was a very large cat, tawny color, with a very long tail.
Yeah.
And I saw it clearly. And we're probably in Richland County, the very edge of Richland County, almost into Vernon County. And this was February.
Mm-hmm.
Running through the snow.
Well, you know, there are lots of sightings on an annual basis. They're being tabulated by both the DNR and by a student group under the direction of Dr. Eric Anderson at UW-Stevens Point. And there are folks becoming increasingly interested in trying to establish a protocol for dealing with and managing for cougars in Wisconsin, because there are obviously some here and there may be more in the future. I didn't answer the question about territory because it appeared that in the case of this cat in Burnett County, it was moving through. So territory is not necessarily a relevant term in discussing these cougars that are dispersing from the Dakotas. The one, for example, in Milton, last year was traced across Rock County and then through southeastern Wisconsin, and as you may have heard, ended up killed by police in Chicago. So there was the territory just wasn't relevant. This was an animal that was moving in a literally hundreds of miles in a straight line and had not set up a territory. Once they do, and then you have a resident cat, whether it's in South Dakota or Wisconsin, then for an animal this size, we're talking about a pretty large block of land in terms of it wandering over on a day-to-day basis. Square miles, not just acres.
Yeah.
And they will coexist with coyote?
No problem there.
Okay, because we do have coyote, and our coyote have, quote, played, unquote, with our dogs. Literally, they play a chase game, and then they stop and rest, and then the chasee becomes the chaser, and they do that back and forth. We've watched them.
Well, as I said when we talked about this before, there have been numerous accounts of this behavior, but again, the intention of all concerned is known only to them.
Right.
But in some cases, no good comes from it. In some cases, no bad comes from it either, but it makes me a little nervous.
It does us too.
But in terms of coyotes and cougars, I mean, the stronghold of both of these animals is the American West, and they're both in the same basic place.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Jim Packard there examining the emails that are coming in and taking your calls. Larry Mueller here. I'm glad to have you along. Give us a call with your questions or email us at the email is talk@wpr.org. The call is 800-642-1234. Walter's been waiting a long time from Appleton, so we better go to Walter here and see what's on his mind. Hi, Walter.
Good morning. Good afternoon now. What I would like to point out is that we have problems with birds hitting our windows. Someone suggested we put something in the window. We went to a store and bought a door that has the bobbles hanging down and strings, cut them off, and hung them about 3 to 5 inches apart in our windows. It has reduced the strikes on our windows of birds, especially dirty mourning doves, and has really helped a lot with that problem.
You're absolutely right, Walter. But there are two issues here. One that we were talking about earlier is that the territorial issue of the bird actually attacking the window. And the other is the probably, in my mind, the more serious problem of birds just thinking they can see through and wham, they hit the window and they're killed. And that problem is often solved a little differently. And suspending things that move around or putting up a hawk or an owl silhouette on the window or really anything that gives the birds the notion, wait a minute, maybe this isn't a clear tunnel through to the other side, will reduce the bird collisions. But the issue of territorial attacks on the window is much more difficult to solve.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that tip. And Dan in Portage, we're on to you. Hi, Dan.
Yes, I have built several of the birdhouses that Scott had in his book.
Shell's Houses and Feeders? Yep.
It's the Wren, Swallow, and Bluebird House.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, if I recall, it had a 1-inch opening for the hole. And I built several of them and put them out. And I find wrens in them, a lot of them. It seems like the bluebirds fly up there and they poke their head in there, in and out a few times, and then move on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been other bluebird houses that I've seen that have much larger openings.
Yes, I think that's correct. That's a small opening for bluebirds, and I think most of the houses are going to be talking more an inch and a quarter, inch and a half, and even an opening where you essentially cut two offset circles and then join them with a jigsaw or whatnot, so you essentially end up with up and down kind of an oval, not oval, but elliptical or a racetrack-shaped hole as opposed to just the circle. But, again, there are many different designs in there, but things like the Peterson House and the Baldry House and some others that are in there and in other references will, I think, give you a little larger hole.
Yep.
But you don't want to get it too big because then the sparrows and the starlings become a problem.
And the owls can get in, too.
Right.
Okay. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, if you make that hole too big, somebody said that makes for a great owl feeder.
All I've created, I just put up my new bluebird houses last weekend and took down some old ones, and they basically become condominiums for white-footed mice. They were just packed with mice, which is okay. I don't mind the mice. They've got to live somewhere, but I ended up dumping out some of the mouse nesting material, still with plenty of mice in there, and the little guys were running up my leg, which is what they perceive. Hey, there's the first place to get away. Go up that tree. And I didn't like that very much.
Okay. Tom in Shell Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I've got a cabin on about a 9-acre field, and I put the bluebird houses up or cleaned them out a couple of weeks ago, and last Thursday they arrived. Mm-hmm. Had a nesting pair going in and out. And over the last 3 or 4 days, it's been kind of snowy and bad weather, and I haven't seen them. I'm not out there all the time. I also have a northern harrier that flies around this field looking for things, and I don't know if the bluebirds are just hiding out or if this northern harrier maybe scared them away, or I don't know why I'm not seeing them the last couple of days.
I don't think that's anything to worry about, Tom. Wait until the weather moderates. They may just be lying low, holed up in a box or off somewhere where there's a little bit of shelter. Or they may have moved on, but they'll be back or other ones will be back. And I don't think you need to worry about the harrier too much.
Okay.
Can I ask one more question about crows?
Yep.
I've got a little apple orchard with 20 apple trees in it. And last fall, once the apples start turning red, I had crows that were just devastating them, just pecking holes in them. And is there anything to do about that? I tried a fake owl, and it didn't work at all.
Well, a fake owl is actually counterproductive because that's often used as a crow decoy, essentially, to bring crows in, attacking the owl, and then for hunting purposes. So, that's a tough one. Depending on the size of the trees, you know, it may be possible with smaller dwarf trees to net some of them, you know, just when the apples are vulnerable. You can get this bird netting in huge sheets, but it's a pain in the neck to apply and to take off the tree. It snags on everything, but it will solve the problem.
These are dwarf apple trees, and I keep them trimmed down so they're only about 6-7 feet tall, so maybe you could hang it over them?
You can just hang it over them, or, you know, I've seen some commercial groves where they'll actually build kind of an elevated frame, depending on the spacing, kind of down between the rows, and then drape the netting over the frame so it's not snagging so badly on the trees.
Sure.
You may have to tailor something to your particular situation, but if I had a particularly, you know, a Honeycrisp tree that had $200 worth of apples on it, I'd be real tempted to try and net the tree and keep them off there. Other than that, the old-fashioned scarecrow might work. If something kind of an old wives, well, I shouldn't say it was an old wives' tale because it had some merit, but back in New England, it was quite common for gardeners, if they could lay their hands on a dead crow, either found along the road, which is unusual, crows are pretty wary, or somebody hunting crows, you know, give them a dead crow, then essentially putting that in a tree seemed to discourage the other crows. But I don't necessarily advocate going out and, you know, obtaining or trying to kill a crow just for that purpose. I just don't know of any repellents or other tactics, you know, whatever you can think of for streamers. There is one thing that you might try hanging just for a short-term relief, and that's a scare-eye balloon. It's a bird scare tactic that, again, garden centers and hardware stores will carry. It's essentially a beach ball, a couple feet in diameter. You blow it up, but it's got big mylar eye spots on it. They were actually developed in Japan, and then some streamers that hang down on the bottom. And if you could get that up above the trees on a, you know, a tall shepherd's crook or however else you want to do it, so that bounces around and flashes a bit, I got a feeling that at least for a few days when you're right around the harvest season, might help a little bit.
Might help. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Stephanie in La Crosse, we're on to you now. Hi, Stephanie.
Yes, hello. I live on the Mississippi River, and I did not realize eagles could swim. I saw an eagle run or dive into the river to get either a large fish or a muskrat, and it swam halfway across the main channel, was using its wings like our arms.
Uh-huh. It's a pretty neat sight, isn't it? I watched them in Manitouish Lake, Lake Manitouish in northern Wisconsin do that.
They're not necessarily doing it intentionally or with great desire, but it happens occasionally that they find themselves in the water, and like any animal, they may not like the water, but they can swim, and they'll usually swim to shore, get out where they can shake off a bit and look a little unhappy about the whole situation, but eventually they'll fly away.
Yeah, but it is a neat sight to watch them use their wings that way. Thanks, Stephanie, for calling. Juan has a question for you. He bought a frog environment for his grandson. Doesn't want to use mail-order tadpoles because of the alien issues. Would like to find or purchase some native tadpoles. Is it illegal to catch them in the wild, or is there a place where they would be available for purchase? I'm trying to think myself.
Well, you know, a place like, I would check with a place like NASCO Scientific, which is right here in southeastern Wisconsin in Fort Atkinson. They offer, you know, frog raising kits and so forth for school classes. That's one possibility. And they may have some native species. You know, I'm a little less concerned in a controlled environment like that. There are certainly some frog species that are available in the pet trade, readily available, fire-bellied toads and African clawed frogs and things like that, that, you know, as long as the people are conscientious about, you know, this is a captive situation, and those frogs or their offspring don't eventually find their way into the backyard, or, well, let's put some of these in the pond, then as long as it's contained, it's not a huge issue. But certainly he's right in not wanting to introduce anything alien into the environment. A little bit later, when the frogs are breeding, you know, it would be possible to collect some, if you find a little pond or hole where the toads have been breeding, for example, there'd be a gazillion little black tadpoles that, you know, a handful of those aren't going to be a big issue and certainly could be used. So
sure.
I think there are a couple possibilities.
All right. And let's see, we have Lauren and Edgerton up next. Lauren, hi.
Hi there. I have a strange little occurrence that's been going on up at our property in Vernon County since last August. We got a grouse that will follow my wife around. And if she's out working in the yard from nowhere, here comes that grouse. And that was this last weekend, we were up there, and she was cleaning the rocks along the driveway. And that grouse actually jumped onto her arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It happens occasionally, and it's even written up in the grouse literature as being an unusual occurrence, but it happens with some regularity over the years. I've had folks report grouse. One gentleman I remember in southwestern Wisconsin, this was a few years ago, whenever he was mowing his lawn with his John Deere lawn tractor, the grouse would come tearing out of the bush and sit on the tractor and ride all around the yard with him. there were a couple videos on YouTube just a few weeks ago. It was a truck driver who stopped to have lunch on the side of a road. I think it was a logging truck driver, and out of the bush came a grouse and, you know, sat on the end of his shoe and tried to jump in the truck cab and, you know, kept him company while he had lunch, and eventually ran down the road behind him when he tried to leave. So I can offer you no particular explanation for it, but it does happen, and whether these birds, you know, have been somehow conditioned to people or, you know, some sort of aberration, they can be incredibly, for lack of a better term, friendly, even sitting on somebody's shoulder, sitting on their head, jumping up on their shoe, riding on a vehicle, on a tractor. It does happen, and it's neat. I'd like to experience, so you can certainly get some good pictures that way.
I've got 8 pictures of it so far.
Oh, that's cool.
And then it tries to get in the house when we go in, like it doesn't want us to leave. It'll try to run into the house with us, so we got to shut the door quick so it doesn't come.
Well, enjoy it while you can. I mean, one of the problems is a bird that's behaving that, you know, that much in the open and so forth is very conspicuous and, you know, is probably more vulnerable to a predator or a cat or something like that. So keep an eye out for it if you can and enjoy it as long as you can.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. We had an email here, and this is about a cougar. And I'm wondering if it's not one of these photos that makes its way around. Unfortunately, the photo didn't come out, but it's a photo of a cougar supposedly killed near Pelican Lake, Wisconsin. The guy who shot it is 6 feet tall. and weighs 200 pounds.
Was it a photo in a shed, kind of, and the guy's holding it with his arms around it? Do we know?
We don't know for sure.
Well, anyway, there have been a couple circulating like that. I don't believe it's a Wisconsin cougar. And any of the ones I've seen, the one where the guy's in the shed, then there's another one where he's outside. It's been attributed to many different locations, but I do not believe it's from Wisconsin.
All right. And let's go to Mary and Merton. Thanks for calling, Mary.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, we were cleaning up along the shore of the lake that we live on, and we found, as usual, the usual debris from the ice fishermen, which we were scooping out of the water, and we found a dead object that, to me, looks like a salamander. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if it was possible that there were salamanders in southeastern Wisconsin in the lake.
Oh, there are definitely salamanders in southeastern Wisconsin and southwestern Wisconsin mm-hmm. and northeastern. It depends. There are 6, 7, 8 species, depending on where you are.
Uh-huh.
And it was this fairly large?
Yeah, it was.
It was maybe a foot long?
Oh, yeah.
Easily. Okay. Was it decomposed or?
It smelled pretty bad. Otherwise, I would have kept it.
Well, you mentioned.
It was big. No, it wasn't decomposed that badly. You know, you could see the legs,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of a gray speckled looking with kind of a flat, wide tail.
Yeah, that's a mud puppy.
It's a mud puppy.
It's a fairly common aquatic salamander, in particularly in larger lakes and river systems around Wisconsin. They never come out of the water. You may have been able to detect that right behind the head, it would have had external gills, kind of feathery gills like a fish's gills that fan out outside the animal rather than inside, and then short stubby legs and a big flattened tail, flattened up and down rather than top to bottom.
Right.
And they're generally grayish and speckled. They live in the lake. It may have died of natural causes, or they are occasionally caught by fishermen, including ice fishermen. I saw a really big one caught in University Bay on a minnow on a tip-up years ago in Lake Mendota. But usually the ice fishermen say, oh, my gosh, what is this thing? And they're unbelievably slimy and writhe around. And it may have been a casualty of a fishing operation. It may have died on its own. But I'm pretty sure it was a big mud puppy.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
That answers the question. Thanks very much for calling. Pat in Suamico, Green Bay area, says we were surprised to see this big guy, and she's got a photo here of a pileated. Two pileateds hanging around outside their house. They both had similar markings, like they were both males. Could you help me identify the male versus the female of a pileated woodpecker? She just has the one picture here, but...
Well, it's a black and white picture, so you can't see much of the crest. And I'm not sure there's a whole lot to choose between the two, actually, Larry.
No.
I'd have to refer to a bird book, too, and that's what I'd recommend Pat do, is either look at a bird book or look online. It's clearly a pileated, and they do travel in pairs and communicate with each other. And if it was around my house, I'd be, as long as it's at the feeder or a dead tree, that's great. But a pileated is the last woodpecker you want to take an affinity to your wood house because they can really open some big holes. But I can't tell from the picture who's who there.
Barb in Mayville, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Barb.
Hi. My question is, do you think spring turkey hunting disturbs ground nesting birds or tree nesting birds? It's a lot of human disturbance for 6 weekends.
Not in the slightest, actually, although it's... Yes, there are a lot of folks out, but they're widely spread around the landscape. I can think now in terms of my spring turkey hunting over the last 10 or 15 years. I'm trying to think if I've ever seen another turkey hunter in the woods. I don't think I have.
I haven't, other than the guy that I hunt with.
So, if you're hunting together, you might see somebody, but the hunters are widely distributed. Mm-hmm. They ordinarily head into the woods in the dark and usually sit in a very unobtrusive location. They're fully camouflaged. From my experience, in terms of birds active or moving through the brush line I might be sitting in, they'll literally sit on you or come very close. In fact, that's one of the things I really enjoy about turkey hunting is all the stuff you see when you're sitting out there in full camouflage and nothing knows you're there. Mm. So unless someone actually happened to sit on or step on a ground nest of any kind, I don't believe there's any impact at all, and no more so than the morel hunters looking for mushrooms in the spring, or just people out working on their land, pulling garlic mustard or cutting brush or doing anything else. So,
okay, thanks.
No problem.
Thanks a lot for calling.
On that subject, since turkeys came up, we should point out that the first spring turkey season opens, I think, on April 15th.
Right.
Runs for 6 5-day periods, Wednesday to Sunday thereafter. And the recent sale of the leftover turkey permits was just completed. And I am thrilled to report that it was a big success. Thousands of permits were distributed to people who wanted them. A lot of money was raised. And there were no huge computer glitches as there were in the past couple of years. So it was great.
And, Scott, just I know we were going to talk about a few other things relating to spring and our wildlife, and maybe we should do that before.
Well, let me just run down a little bit of a list here. And I wanted to be sure, too, to mention to the listeners this new book that we just received yesterday entitled The Recovery of Gray Wolves in the Great Lakes Region of the United States, an Endangered Species Success Story. It's a really nice, very detailed book by Adrian Whitehaven, our good friend in the DNR, Tim Van Dielen in my own department, and Ed Heskey, all as editors. It runs the gamut through the history of wolves in the upper Great Lakes to the current situation and where we go from here. Anybody interested in any aspect of the wolf issue, pro con or indifferent, will find this a very interesting book. Published by Springer, it's available on their website and at Amazon.com. Nice book.
We'll have to get the authors on for a program. That'd make a nice program. Jim, you'll have to make a note of that.
We thought about some frog calls, too, but I'll just say from a spring standpoint, the chorus frogs have already started down here. I'd expect wood frogs in the north once the ice finally melts. So that's going to be underway. People are out now finding overwinter damage in their yards from voles and early mole activity and so forth. There's not a whole lot that can be done about that except to learn a lesson that it's going to happen again next winter and take steps in the fall to prevent it. So we'll talk about that more in the fall. Baby animals are going to start to turn up. That's always an issue. What do you do about them? Leave them alone. Unless they're in immediate danger. We can talk more about that, too. Get your bird houses up, bird migrations on. Watch out for that salmonella issue at the feeders. But get out, get those great birding trail guides we've talked about, and get out and look around. There's lots of neat stuff to see. The waterfowl migration, the general bird migration, turkey behavior. You don't have to hunt turkeys. Just get out there and see them. They're spectacular.
Yeah,
there's nothing more spectacular than a big gobbler turkey strolling up to you in full strut when you're calling to them. It's a pretty neat thing. Think about garden protection as you're starting to get your seeds and onion sets and things like that ready. Fence is a good idea. Protect those spring bulbs. Watch out for skunks. They're out thick this time of year. You don't want to be sprayed. Conservation Congress. Week from next Monday, the 13th of April. Monday night, 7 o'clock, every county in the state. Chance to get out and have your voice heard.
When
on
is
all
it
sorts.
Again now?
It'll be Monday, April 13th, 7 p.m., there'll be a site in every county. It's an opportunity for everybody to have their voices heard. I think I hear a frog in the
well,
background.
Well, I was just...
let's listen. By running a fingernail... This will be the chorus
this
frog
This is the
coming
chorus
up.
Frog, because I wanted to sort of end the show with the chorus frogs.
There we
and,
go.
And there we go. Well, with the sound of the chorus frogs in the background, Scott, thank you so much for being with us today. You won't be back. See, you will be back the first Monday or first Wednesday of June.
Yes.
Well, so we'll look forward to that. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. And it's always fun to have him with us. And it's fun to hear those chorus frogs, too, isn't it? Love that sound. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the International Year of Astronomy, and we'll also take a look at ecopreneuring, as in, something different. Stay with us on the Ideas Net.